The winter wheat tour has officially come to a close, and the impacts of a lingering drought suggest that an all-time low yield might be in the offing. What farmers need to know about wheat supplies in the years ahead? Today on Field Posts. Is a DTN Progressive Farmer podcast that dives deeper into the most important trends in agriculture to explore the business's cutting edge. I'm your host, Sarah Mock. On May 17th, the annual Winter Wheat Tour wrapped up its survey of the Southern Plains wheat crop with its report on predicted yield averages, which indicated that the persistent impact of droughts has indeed driven wheat production to near record lows in this region. Progressive Farmer Senior Editor Joel Richenberger made his way to Colby, Wichita, and finally Manhattan, Kansas this week with more than 100 fellow surveyors to see fields across the state firsthand and bring us the latest reactions from farmers, bakers, millers, and industry experts from across the country. Today, we'll talk about the weather impacts that affected various regions of Kansas and what they might mean for abandonment rates, yields, and plantings of secondary crops as we move towards harvest. Plus, we'll dig into other pressures, from pests to irrigation to protein levels, right after this word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by the 2023 Virtual Ag Summit Series. The next Ag Summit Series event is coming up soon. Here's Katie Dellinger with more on what you can expect and how to participate.
We're going to meet for our next Ag Summit Series on May 23rd. And we're calling it Crop Updates from the Field, because hopefully by then the crop is in, it's up, and farmers will really have a better idea of what they're looking at. They'll be able to start discussing what kind of weeds they're seeing, what kind of emergence they had, any concerns they may be having about pests early on, and getting a perspective on what they're gonna do. So we're going to bring in a lot of farmers from across the growing region to talk about what they're seeing on their farms. We're going to have a presentation from KJ Johnson. He's the president of the Illinois Chemical and Fertilizer Association. He's going to talk a little bit more about some of the new dicamba deadlines that are out there for certain states. He's going to talk about what he's hearing as far as some of the agronomic need to know for the year. Then we'll also have updates on that summer weather as we're moving into it. And then we'll have Todd Holtman to do a real deep dive into the markets, where they're going, what the trends are. Is there going to be a chance for an in-growing season rally for farmers to make a marketing decision? Sounds like a lot. It is a lot, but we're going to make good use of farmers' time. We're going to take about 3 hours in the morning of May 23rd to really dig into these topics. We're going to have the option for some interaction at the end of it as well. We're going to have a Zoom room chat, and I'm really excited to see what farmers have to say and how they interact. It's important to know that the Ag Summit Series events are completely free. We really just want farmers to show up, participate, and get access to this information. It's a different way to hear from many of the voices you hear on DTNPF.com and really get a chance to get deep in this information. We have most of the outline of our schedule and a lot of other information about how to register online already at DTN.com/2023-ag-summit-series.
Now, back to the show. Progressive Farmer Senior Editor Joel Richenberger joins us today to discuss his recent experience at the annual wheat tour. Joel,
I wonder if you can start by talking a little bit about expectations going into this year's wheat tour. Personal expectations, what kind of the industry was thinking they were going to see out there in Kansas.
Yeah, as soon as I started reporting on this year's wheat crop, heading into this tour, the conversation immediately turned to, this is the worst since when? And some of the dates floated out there were since 1996, when I think there was real bad freeze damage in 96, or since 1989, when there was a bad drought. There's a lot of abandonment in 1989. Or in terms of strictly bushels produced, the kind of the outlier in bushels produced is 1963, the last year that Kansas didn't come above 200 million bushels of wheat produced. And so that was what we were going in expecting to see was, okay, we know this is bad. This is going on year three of a drought here in the state of Kansas, but how bad is it? What are we going to see out there? So the expectations were very low, I would say.
And for folks who maybe aren't familiar, give us a little bit of an overview of exactly how the wheat tour works before we get into the numbers.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. There were 105 people there, and there were a couple journalists like me. There were a lot of people with the milling and baking industry, which was certainly a part of the industry I've not personally had a lot of exposure to. There were a lot of grain traders and people in the markets. There were a lot of analysts. There were researchers from K-State. There were some farmers. There were agronomists. And everyone was out there for their own reasons looking, wanted to see it for themselves. And usually this will attract about 60, maybe 70 people. I think they knew going into last year they were expecting a lot of drought last year. And so that attracted a bigger crowd up to 80 or 85. And this year, it was almost like there's a car crash effect. Everyone wanted to rubberneck and see it themselves. And so there were 105 people, which was by far and away the record for the tour. And so we all show up in Manhattan on Monday evening. They give us a tutorial on how to count, how to figure yield, and do some of the math we're going to do. They gave us a brief lecture on the state of this year's crop and what they were expecting, and some of those numbers like I was talking about, like years past, how it might compare to years past. And then we all got assigned a car, and so there are four of us to a car, and the driver of the cars was usually someone who'd either done a bunch of wheat tours or who had some experience or who was one of the leaders in the industry. So usually there was somebody in your car who had a pretty good idea what was going on, and for the most part it seemed the other people in the car had maybe been on one or two tours, or for a lot of us, it was our first time. For me, it was our first time. And then there are six routes. And so there are 27 cars. So you're split up into about four or five or six cars per route. And there's a pink route and a purple route and a green route. So we woke up Tuesday morning and met our driver. And one route might go north out of Manhattan. And then ultimately, we all met up in Colby, Kansas, which is in the northwest-ish corner of the state. People in true northwest Kansas might object to Colby being called far northwest, but as far as most people is concerned, it would be northwest. But yeah, we all made our way there by different routes. For the most part, you stayed on the same highways, and you'd drive by, and you'd see other crews. You'd see another car in the field. Oh, we got to find a different wheat field. But sometimes some cars would deviate a little bit, stay within the same kind of corridor, but maybe take a smaller road or something, make sure they got to some fields that hadn't been seen. And so we were seeing like 200 fields a day, I think, between our 27 cars. And then we all get together that night, and someone in the car is in charge of recording data from all the fields we stopped at. And then that data all gets reported once we get to the night's stop, which the first night was Colby and the second night was Wichita. And then the third was Manhattan, and all that data gets calculated, and they produce a daily average of the day's yields as predicted in the fields we stopped at and the data we gather.
Talk to us about day one then. What did you see? What was the conclusions after that first day in the field?
So we certainly all launched into it expecting a pretty rough wheat crop. And so when you go in with that expectation, anytime you see something that's, oh, this isn't truly awful, you're kind of impressed. And so some of the first fields we saw weren't quite that bad. They had other issues. There were some issues that maybe, I think everyone was so focused on the drought that there were some other issues that perhaps I think people were aware of, but maybe hadn't been considered quite as much. We saw quite a bit of freeze damage that first day from some late spring freezes in the state. We didn't see a lot of, we saw some hail damage. We were in one field that had pretty obvious drought damage, pretty obvious hail damage, and pretty obvious freeze damage. Like, man, this was one unlucky guy here, one unlucky farmer. But the freeze was a little more central, and the further west we got, certainly the more drought you saw. But it would almost be in bands, because right around Manhattan, the first couple stops, it was, okay, this is decent wheat. Maybe there was the freeze, maybe there was some hail, but this is not a disaster. Then we got a little further, and we got maybe into central or west central Kansas. And north of Salina is roughly where we were at. And we saw some real bad fields there. But then we got a little further west, got a little close to Colby, and things turned back up a little bit. And again, we're not talking 50 or 60 bushels. We're talking 20 or 30 bushels. We're talking, okay, this would probably be worth harvesting. This is not a complete disaster. Probably not even 30 bushels, to be frank. Probably more like 15 or 20. And so that was just interesting. It's just so much just seemed to rely upon the track of storms. And that kind of maybe that west central part missed a couple rains that a little closer to Colby that they got. But Colby's certainly no oasis in all this either. So it was a mixed bag the first day. I think our average after the first day was 29.8, which is certainly very low for Kansas standards, but was maybe not quite the epic disaster some of us were expecting. But we definitely got into some epic disaster terrain as well later on.
What about day two? things turn around at all?
That was definitely the epic disaster. So my car, we headed kind of straight south from Colby, and we got all the way down to Liberal, which is about as far south and west of Kansas as you can go. It was just a couple miles from the Oklahoma line. And there was a crew that actually did go into Oklahoma and check some wheat there. But we got all the way down to Liberal, and boy, from about the central, for all the way along the west edge of Kansas, from about the central point down, from about Scott City south to Liberal, it was really rough. And we saw a lot of wheat that had already been sprayed and terminated. We saw a lot that we couldn't quite figure out why it hadn't until we really started, you know, trying to apply some logic to it. And there just hadn't been any rain. Kansas has had some rain in the last week or two, which has been a nice reprieve, but it, for the most part, came too late for the wheat. It might help fill some of the heads, but the heads aren't getting any taller. And boy, we were looking at just such short plants. They're going to be a struggle. Like physically, there'll be a struggle to harvest because the headers can only go so low sometimes. And they're not going to grow any taller once they start sprouting ahead. So the rain at that point doesn't do a lot of good. But boy, we were in areas where it did not look like it had even rained recently. They even missed some of these recent storms. And so, boy, why hadn't they killed it? We kill it to do what, I guess, was the question. Because you could follow up with Milo. And that's what some people in other parts of the state are doing. They're killing it to follow up with Milo or sorghum or maybe soybeans and still salvage something from this year in terms of a harvest. But out there, you're just planting failed seed in good seed after bad seed. And there's been no moisture to change the game at all. So there's no reason your sorghum is going to grow when your wheat didn't grow. So we certainly could understand maybe why there's no real point. It felt just funny out there because like there was just nothing happening. There wasn't hardly anybody in the fields, anybody doing anything because there was just nothing to do. They couldn't plant whatever plans they had for fall crops, be it corn or soybeans or sorghum. They couldn't plant any of that because there was the same reason the wheat was dead. And there was no point in finishing off the wheat because, again, what are you going to do? So it was really surreal, honestly. We're driving past all these fields where there was nothing happening. And that's in spring in Kansas, that's not necessarily, it feels unusual to not see anything happening in any of the fields. And then we got down all the way down to Liberal again, the way southwest corner. And then we kind of head back towards Wichita. And pretty quickly, you could just tell they'd just been a little more lucky with the rain. And the wheat got back to respectable, at least. A lot back to, this probably doesn't need to be completely destroyed. So the very worst of it was the southwest corner and kind of the western half in general. And other than that, it just seemed real spotty. And we still drove past fields that had been destroyed or that would be destroyed. But you started to find more fields that had, for whatever reason, been a little more fortunate. Either they got real lucky with a spotty rain cloud at the right time, or maybe they were planted before they were planted in time to catch some rain, while some others was maybe planted a week or two later and was not so lucky. Or maybe, I'm sure, a factor was the practices going into that year. Had it been fallow? Because you could probably still get a nice crop if you hadn't had anything at all on the ground the year before. Or depending on what you were following up, probably was also a factor in the quality of the crop you were able to raise in this year's conditions.
And what about the third day?
The third day was definitely a lot quicker. We definitely didn't sample nearly as extensively. We left Wichita, headed up towards Manhattan. We stopped at four fields. And again, we saw a real wide array of stuff. We saw first field we went in, it looked great from the road. And I was like, oh, here, let's pull over here. This looks like a nice field. You get out there, it was just chock full of weeds and a real mess. And that farmer, poor farmer's got a real mess on his hands. And so we took a sample there that wasn't particularly good. We ended up in a couple of fields later that were testing in the 50s, 60s. And we had one field that even tested in the 70s, which sometimes that makes you wonder a little bit about your math and your counting skills. Because, boy, is someone really going to raise 70, 75 bushel wheat in Kansas this year? I don't know about that. And a lot of people don't know about that, I would say. But some of that comes with the territory when you're on the wheat tour. And some there are going to be some nice fields of wheat out there. And it's important not to forget that. There's just going to be a lot of not nice fields also.
And what was the final yield estimate that came out of the wheat tour?
So the final was 30.0. And a lot of that was helped by that last day, because I think a lot of people found nicer fields on that last day as well. And in central Kansas, they weren't quite as drought stricken as the stuff to the west. And so I think the USDA released a number last week that was 2029. And so that was the USDA's prediction. And so one of our big questions was, how are we going to compare to that? So going into the last day, we were at 28.6, I think. And so we were real close, and we ended up right at 30.0, and just a little better than the USDA, but still obviously right in the same neighborhood, which even 29 or 30, that's all very low by modern Kansas standards.
30, I imagine, is inclusive of only harvested fields. There's also the question of abandonment, I think, still out there. Talk about what kind of the tourist perspective came away with expectations around abandonment versus maybe what USDA has been talking about.
We definitely didn't count fields that either clearly had been destroyed or were going to be, or that we had reason to believe weren't going to be harvested. And the figure we were coming up with was the kind of the goal of our endeavor was definitely to try to figure the yield on the harvested crop, what's going to be harvested this year. If it's going to be zeroed out, then it's not going to be harvested. It's going to be turned over to sorghum or soybeans or something else, or left fallow. It's not going to be part of this year's crop. And that's certainly reflected in the USDA. There was 8.1 million acres of wheat estimated to be planted going into this season in 2022 to 2023. And they were estimating there was going to be 6.6 million acres harvested. So that already reflects quite a bit of abandonment, like a major number. So we didn't try to count abandoned fields or anything. In areas where we saw a lot of that, we certainly took mental notes and jotted it down in our notebooks, but that wasn't something we were ultimately figuring.
I'm curious too about other perspectives. Maybe you heard, if you got a chance to talk to any farmers who were either a part of the tour or met along the way, what are farmers thinking, saying about the wheat crop this year?
A lot of them are really struggling with what to do, when to pull the trigger. And I know it's a complex dance, frankly, with obviously a lot of them are talking to their insurance adjusters, having their insurance adjusters come out and check crops and see what kind of number they can get from them. And I know the insurance seems to use a different formula than we do, because a lot of them are getting really minuscule numbers from their insurance adjuster. And okay, is now the time? Like, when do you pull the trigger? If you are going to kill it, or does it still have a chance? Can some of this rain help the head fill a little bit better and still get you an acceptable yield? I know some farmers were looking at 7 bushels to the acre was the line they'd drawn in the sand. If it was going to be below that, then they'd kill it and try to plant something else. It was going to be above it. They were willing to wait and see what happened. And so that's kind of a complex dance that a lot of farmers are dealing with. And other farmers, I kept asking, like, what's the lesson from this? And I think that's one of the frustrating things for all these farmers. There's not really a lesson. You just hope for rain, and it didn't come. And there didn't really necessarily seem to be one farming practice to work better, or any seed that worked better, or any, there was no magic to producing a good crop this year. It's just how lucky you got with the rain. And I think that's one of the frustrating things for farmers who are kind of always looking for a lesson to be learned. What can we learn from this year's crop? And the answer this year is not a lot. Pray for rain. So I think it's hard for farmers to go out and kill that crop when the time is appropriate. And it seemed to be a lot of stress about the right way to go about all this.
I can't imagine that anything besides the drought was really very top of mind for folks, besides maybe frost and hail. But any pest conversations while you're out there? Any signs of maybe insects or weeds that were particularly problematic for farmers this year?
Not real bad. We were in that one field that had some weeds, but if I was in 50 fields this week, weeds were an issue in literally one of them. So yeah, that was one interesting element of it. And there wasn't a lot of weeds. We didn't see very much disease issues. Again, a little bit, but not very much. We didn't see very much bug pressure. I think a lot of that goes back to the drought. There wasn't a lot of healthy crop to infest. So it really wasn't a big issue this year, it didn't seem like.
And related to the yield issue as well, I'm curious whether there were conversations or any testing done around protein. I know that as relates to the yield question, protein's top of mind for folks. So especially if there were millers and bakers on the tour. So what, any thoughts there?
Yeah, it is going to be a really interesting year with regard to protein, because I know that's ultimately something that Kansas farmers are trying to put a little more emphasis on. But this has come about the last couple of years when there's been a lot of drought stress, which leads to high protein yields, high protein wheat anyway. So any of the practices that might lead to higher protein have certainly not been necessary. Exactly how that relates to the baking and milling industry is interesting, and that's certainly something I'm still learning about. I had a conversation with one person on the tour that's in that field, and she was referencing how they're going to have to blend in some other wheat to bring down the protein content of Kansas wheat. And that's one of her takeaways, is that there's almost going to be too much protein
Looking maybe a little bit to the future, you mentioned farmers maybe don't feel like there was much of a lesson to learn this year other than pray for rain. But I'm curious whether you, as part of conversations with farmers, were you hearing people talk about like fallowing more fields, maybe moving away from wheat, maybe thinking about this region differently going forward? Or are folks still just think that this was just an exceptionally bad year after a couple of rather exceptionally bad years and that things will inevitably eventually get better?
That's interesting. When we got to talking about this is the worst year since when, I go back into some of the archives, and that's always interesting to look back on reports from like the harvest of 1963 or something, for instance. And I got to looking at the land use in Kansas back then, and there are not a whole lot less acres of wheat planted, but there's a whole lot more of other crops, soybeans and corn, than there were back then. I think corn went from 2 million acres planted then to like 5 or 6 planted now. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that change. And certainly, I think growing dry land corn is easier now than it used to be. And so is that process going to continue? I don't know that this is going to change anything. I think for farmers, this is just an unfortunate part of the game, part of the life. I guess it's the impression that I had with how they were seeing it. I didn't talk to anybody that was contemplating any major changes in crop rotation or a lifestyle or practice or anything like that. I think they just saw this as them's the breaks.
And I'm curious too, driving around out there in Kansas, what did you see as far as irrigation? More adoption of irrigation? Does that seem like there's more interest in that? What is the kind of like irrigation picture as drought persists?
Yeah, the best wheat fields, you know, even in that area, Kansas, I was just describing it as being dried up and looking horrible. There were some irrigated wheat fields out there that did look pretty healthy. And so those are going to be okay. In terms of happening more, I don't have hard data on this, but that's a really interesting question. I'd be stunned if there's increasing acres of irrigation in Western Kansas. I've talked to a number of farmers who have talked about getting off irrigation. In fact, I was riding with one in one of my cars. He talked about how much irrigation he's had to quit using since he took over the farm from his father. And I've talked to some other farmers out there in that corner of the state who have had to quit using irrigation as their wells have gone dry. And that has totally changed the way they farm. And they went from having irrigation and the challenges and expenses and benefits that can bring to getting by on strictly dry land. And that's a really interesting conversation. Something I'm really hoping to dive into deeper here in the near future, actually. But I don't think anyone is adding irrigation acres at this point. But again, I haven't necessarily sought out hard data on that. My data is strictly anecdotal, but they're good anecdotes to make for interesting stories.
I'm curious how results from the tour kind of fit into the broader scope of the wheat picture in the U.S. for this year, the coming months. What is catching your attention in terms of following either wheat markets or wheat production for 2023?
It'll be really interesting. Kansas is looking at the official projection. When you took the 30 bushels per acre times 6.6 million, that puts you right at 200 million in terms of the Kansas wheat production. And Kansas is usually the leading production state for wheat in the country, you know, and so if you're down, I think last year was like 240 million bushels. And so if this year comes in at 200 or 190, or everybody that was on the tour jotted down a guess as to what the ultimate production from this year's crop would be, and then threw a dollar into a hat, whoever's closest wins. I didn't take that number super seriously, but the average of those guesses ended up being in the 170s rather than the 190s. So I don't know how seriously to take that. So take it for what it's worth that the tour's guesses ended up being lower than its calculated data. I do think ultimately people's opinions were probably that the 198, which if you take 30 times 6.6 million, it gets you to 198 million bushels. I think people ultimately thought that was probably generous, but I'm not confident enough in our guess number of 178 million was the average of our guesses. Kansas was at roughly 250 million bushels last year of harvested wheat. It's definitely going to be 50, 60, 70, 80 million bushels shy of that this year. So yeah, that certainly seems like that's going to be a factor in the national market. That's a lot of grain to be shy. But what exactly does that for the market and what that means for the price of wheat is that goes over my head. That's above my pay grade.
Final question. Other stories that you are working on or thinking about that our listeners should be on the lookout for in the next couple months?
Let's see. I got some photography coming up shortly. I got a story on some new Coyote tractors, some new small tractors in their lineup. That's interesting about just kind of the state of a small tractor. the small tractor game. I really start diving into photography here as we get into the summer with when it comes to when we have, of course, our America's Best Young Farmers program, and me and one of my coworkers go out and meet each one of the candidates, and he does the writing and I do the photography. And so that kind of eats up a lot of my summer. And it's one of my favorite parts about it. You get to get around the country and meet farmers doing all kinds of different stuff from each other. But then I have so much in common too. And that's always really fun to just see the huge differences between regions. I've been working for years, and I think I've at least mentioned to you offline about my story about farming on Civil War battlefields. And that one will be ready for the website soon. I've been working on that and very excited about that one. So that's going to be really interesting. I've had the chance to meet with a number of farmers who farm on Civil War battlefields, which in and of itself is interesting, but really lends itself to a bigger discussion about land use and the price of land in some of these places, which I think is really interesting when it comes to what's it worth preserving some of this farmland and what's the best way to do that and what's the right thing for the country and for the farmers in the area. And I don't think there's people who disagree in a big way, but I think there's some small things that could be some kind of really interesting conflicts there that I'm hoping to dive into with that story.
You can read more about the Winter Wheat Tour and stay up to date on all of Joel's reporting at dtnpf.com or in the monthly DTN Progressive Farmer magazine. This episode of Field Post was brought to you by the team at DTN Progressive Farmer, with special thanks to Joel Richenberger. This episode was produced and edited by me, Sarah Mock, with support by Greg Hillier, Kylie Swanson, and Susan Payne. And a big thanks to all of you for listening. If you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And until next time, remember, the future of farming is here. This episode of Field Post is brought to you by DTN Ag Weather Station. Are you looking to get more accurate, hyper-local weather information? By gathering weather and agronomic data directly from your own fields, DTN Ag Weather Station supports you when making targeted decisions around expensive or high-risk activities like chemical applications and irrigation. DTN's Ag Weather Station can be purchased for as low as $9 a month depending on your current customer status with DTN. If you're looking to increase your weather accuracy while saving time, please visit dtn.com.